In a chapter called The Phoenix, Bernhard Schreiber writes as follows. Especially since the last World War, we have done much to infiltrate the various social organizations throughout the country, and in their work and in their point of view, one can see clearly how the principles for which this society and others stood in the past have become accepted as part of the ordinary working plan of these various bodies. That is as it should be, and while we can take heart from this, we must be healthily discontented and realize that there is still more work to be done along this line. Similarly, we have made a useful attack upon a number of professions. The two easiest of them, naturally, are the teaching profession and the church. The two most difficult are law and medicine. If we are to infiltrate the professional and social activities of other people, I think we must imitate the totalitarians and organize some kind of fifth column activity. John Rawlings Rees, M.D., from his address to the annual meeting of the National Council for Mental Hygiene, June 18, 1940. And then the author, that of course, a quote from John Rawlings Rees, then a quote from the author as he continues with his account of the men behind Hitler. During the war, the name of eugenics became even more heavily associated with the Nazis, and consequently afterwards a whitewashing procedure began, the first step of which was the reconstruction of the various national councils of mental hygiene. The first to be refounded was the British National Association for Mental Health. But before we go into detail on this, a bit of history is important. Montague Norman had been governor of the Bank of England for many years. He and his right-hand man, Otto Niemeyer, of German origin, had persistently backed the rearming of Germany, made loans to Germany, and encouraged the financiers of the city of London to do the same. Norman supported and financed Germany's cause right up until the declaration of war. When German troops crashed into Czechoslovakia in September of 1938, Germany claimed Czech assets. They applied through the Bank for International Settlements, of which Norman was a director, for the release of Czech gold held in the Bank of England. The financial tomfoolery that followed would leave anyone confused, but the outcome was that £6 million worth of Czech gold was transferred to Hitler's government, released by Norman. Before the war, Norman attended the christening of the son of his comrade in arms, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, Minister of Finance and President of the Reichsbank, and in July of 1942 was suspected of having visited Schacht in Germany during the war. This alleged visit has always been dismissed by stating that Schacht was in fact being held in a concentration camp for disagreeing with Hitler, and obviously Norman would have been unable to visit him there. The documents of the Nuremberg trials, however, show quite clearly that Schacht had only been sent to the concentration camp in 1944, more than 2 years after the suspected visit by Norman. Whether or not he visited Schacht remains a mystery, but that he did financially support Germany is a recorded fact. Norman had married Priscilla Koch de Guren, now Lady Norman, and was a disciple of Dame Evelyn Fox, long-standing member of the Eugenic Society. In her own words, she was completely dedicated to Evelyn Fox, that is to say, the woman who became Lady Norman. And so Priscilla Norman had been working in the mental hygiene movement since the 1920s. Recommendations had been put forward by Lord Feversham in the week before the war broke out that the Central Association for Mental Welfare, the National Council for Mental Hygiene, and the Mental After Care Association should amalgamate into one organization. So for the duration of the war, a Provisional Association for Mental Health was formed under the chairmanship of Lady Norman. At the end of the war, Montague and Priscilla Norman gave themselves wholeheartedly to the establishment of such an association as Lord Feversham had suggested, in which the related organizations were amalgamated. As Montague had retired in 1944, he dedicated himself completely to his wife's scheme and complemented her methods with his own. From meetings at Thorpe Lodge, the home of the Normans, the National Association for Mental Health became a reality and the framework for similar changes to take place in the rest of the world. Otto Niemeyer was made treasurer and the next phase began. Upon the invitation of the NAMH, the International Committee for Mental Hygiene held a congress at the Ministry of Health in London, where it formally established itself under the new name World Federation for Mental Health, or WFMH. Interrupting, that's the organization that Dr. Villinger was heavily involved with, the German veteran of the mental hygiene movement and the euthanasia program. Of the WFMH, Schreiber continues, it became the international coordinator for national mental health and mental hygiene groups in many countries of the world, and besides a new name, the meeting initiated a change in the direction of its activities. Already, we see the strong involvement of the NAMH in the WFMH, and in future history, the NAMH succeeded in exerting considerable influence in the activities of the WFMH. Lady Norman was appointed to the executive board of WFMH, and with Otto Niemeyer's niece, Mary Appleby, as the general secretary of the British NAMH, the chain was complete. Miss Appleby's previous experience in the German section of the British Foreign Office would serve her well. The first elected president of the WFMH was Dr. John Rawlings Rees, a British psychiatrist who was quoted at the beginning of this chapter. Interrupting, that's the fellow who said we have to take lessons from Hitler and Mussolini. Continuing, the full lecture details a plan whereby each mental hygienist operates as a lone agent, constantly feeding propaganda to private individuals and groups without naming the mental hygiene movement as the true sponsor. He asks that constant propaganda be fed to and pressure put on universities, educational establishments, medicine, press, parliament, magazines and weeklies, literary figures, filmmakers, medical students, civil servants and trade union leaders to obtain the goals of the mental hygiene movement without the movement ever being named. In 1948, when he was elected chairman of the WFMH, he accepted the position of this newly formed and august body. That's John Rawlings Rees. The Congress at which the WFMH was inaugurated was the Third International Congress on Mental Health. A vice president of the Congress was Dr. Carl G. Jung, who had been described by Dr. Conte as, quote, representing German psychiatry under the Nazis, unquote. He had been co-editor of the Journal for Psychotherapy with Dr. M. H. Goering, the cousin of Marshal Hermann Goering. There is definite evidence that Dr. Goering was fully cognizant of the euthanasia murders. Another of the German delegates to the 1948 Congress was Dr. Friedrich Maus, professor of psychiatry at Königsberg University. He denied his connection to the euthanasia program without condemning it by indicating that his invitation to a euthanasia conference was no evidence of his complicity in any such activities. Dr. Adolf Wallmann, a noted psychiatrist in the European League for Mental Hygiene, would have attended if he had not previously stood trial and been imprisoned for the murder of Polish and other laborers in his institution, Hadamar, which had already been emptied by the mass murderer of all of the patients contained therein. Again, the point here being that the World Mental Health Organizations then freely, readily reincorporated not only the international eugenics and mental hygiene movements, but specifically many of the same people who had not only advocated, but in fact had been involved with the Nazi euthanasia and extermination programs. And again, the point here being that the Nazi death camps grew directly out of the euthanasia programs. Not only did the euthanasia programs get the German people acclimated to the idea of official mass state murder, but in addition they served as training grounds in which the procedures and technology could be perfected for the later extermination programs, and in which the personnel could be trained who would later staff the larger death camps. The point being here that when we see euthanasia being proposed in this country, we're seeing something which is very similar to what opened the door for the Nazi extermination programs later on. And I think people should take a very close look at what's going on in society. There is a lot of debate right now concerning the tremendous burden on the healthcare system produced by AIDS, and there's a lot of questions being asked about whether our medical infrastructure can continue to support the growing numbers of AIDS patients. I think in the event of an economic collapse, and we may very well be heading into one, I can see circumstances under which Americans might readily sanction the euthanasia of people who are unfit for one reason or another due to reasons of either health or perhaps race later on. And again, the Nazi euthanasia programs and the Nazi extermination programs grew directly out of mainstream intellectual and cultural movements, which are still with us today in a very, very important way. And I think a tremendous amount of attention should be paid to the growing debate on euthanasia. We haven't talked about it that much on these programs, but the Nazi tactics for getting people accustomed to things they normally would never have put up with was called salami taktik, just like slicing salami one small slice at a time. And I'm going to wind the broadcast up this evening by repeating some material from another miscellaneous archive broadcast called They Thought They Were Free. That program deals with what it was like subjectively for Germans as the Third Reich grew up around them. In other words, it shows people what it was like for them subjectively. And bearing in mind the Nazi salami tactic, how the German people were gradually acclimated to the idea of murder, first through the Nauer case in which this poor beset little girl was put to death, allegedly mercifully, and then they were acclimated to the euthanasia programs, finally the extermination programs. Bear in mind how each step that the Nazis took was not that much greater than the previous step, and see if this doesn't draw to mind some parallels with today. I'm going to read now from a book called They Thought They Were Free, subtitled The Germans 1933 to 1945. The author is Milton Mayer, published in hardcover by the University of Chicago Press, copyright 1955. And in here there's a description by a German university professor. "You see," my colleague went on, "one doesn't exactly see where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to go out of your way to make trouble," unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it, and it is not just fear of standing alone that restrains you, it is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, everyone, unquote, is happy. One hears no protest and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps, there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, "It's not so bad," or "You're seeing things," or "You're an alarmist," unquote. And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end, and how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller, attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it, and then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion, when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you, never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B. And if you did not make a stand at step B, why should you stop at step C? And so on to step D. I think listeners should ask themselves very carefully whether or not the situation just described here, this applying to Nazi Germany, also applies to contemporary America. They might also stop and reflect to what extent the following passage, this in which this university professor describes his own moral corruption, to what extent this may perhaps apply to certain people in the listening audience. And then one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Jew swine," collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed, and changed completely right under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the jobs, the meal times, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system which rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself. That concludes the prepared portion of the broadcast.